This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we remember Lori Lee Salvaggio, a longtime San Luis Obispo community member.
Giving opportunity to her students and kind of a work ethic and a method of leading their lives, whether they were dancers or not, that you work for the things that you want to get in life. They aren't just handed to you.
Also, we'll hear from a local poet who has a new book out.
I expect that school ruined their enthusiasm for poetry because they were inundated with perhaps great poems, but they were way beyond the child's understanding of them.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, January 25th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Since his inauguration last week, President Biden has begun to reverse some of the policies of the former administration. But at the start of the year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced it was reallocating money that was supposed to go toward protecting farm workers. KCBX's Greta Mart recently spoke to Central Coast Congressman Jimmy Panetta to learn about the action taken by the USDA under the Trump administration, to which Panetta refers to in this interview, and how it affects Central Coast farm workers. Here's Panetta.
When we passed the relief package, H.R. 133, in that package, one of the key provisions we fought for and actually had extensive negotiations and discussions with people in the USDA and the administration was to spend no less than $1.5 billion, with a B, for two main purposes. One, the purchase and distribution of agricultural products, and two, to provide grants and loans to agricultural employers or other organizations for the purpose of protecting workers from COVID-19, basically making sure that they have proper PPE so that they can continue to do their job like they have been doing their job throughout this pandemic, showing up to work, doing their job, and helping put food on our table, contributing to our, basically, as I say it, our food security, especially at a time that's so important. Now, what happened was recently we found out that the administration just went ahead and put all that money, at least $1.5 billion of it, just towards food boxes. Now, look, I'm not saying I'm against food boxes, nor am I for supplemental nutrition assistance program type of benefits. But the fact is that we need, in order to get that food, you have to have people to harvest that food, especially in districts like mine, where we're dealing with a lot of specialty crops, where we don't have machines that we can run through the fields. We need people to actually do it. Therefore, we need to protect our people. So once we realize that this is where that money went to, despite the promises that we received from the USDA, I immediately led a letter with Democrats and Republicans, up to 70 of them, to the administration, basically saying, although we appreciate money for food boxes, you need to uphold your promise and make sure that their money goes to protecting the people who are out there in the fields doing the hard work of harvesting our crops, our farm workers. And so that was the main purpose behind this letter that I sent, that I led and was fortunate enough to have, like I said, Democrats and Republicans who understand the importance of protecting our farm workers.
Okay, got it. And can the incoming Secretary of Ag reverse this, or what's going to happen?
It's an excellent question. I'm not necessarily sure they can reverse this, but what they can do is increase the amount, because it was up to it. Like I said, in the bill, it just says no less than $1.5 billion. Therefore, they can make the decision. The new USDA secretary can make the decision to increase spending for PPE to protect our farm workers. And that is basically the goal, I would believe, of this letter, to be frank.
Okay, got it. And were farmers left hanging? I mean, were they expecting grants like in the next couple weeks?
Look, if you talk to anybody in agriculture, you know, they'll tell you, we don't rely on the government. We rely on ourselves. And, you know, we've been helping our farmers and farm workers out as best as we can from the federal perspective, especially with a strategy that this administration has deployed of federally funded, state mandated, locally executed. So with our COVID relief packages, we've been providing the funding necessary for these types of resources as best as we can. However, more need needs to be done. And that's exactly the purpose. That was the purpose of getting that section in the last relief package. It's exactly why we wrote this letter. And it's what we want to do. We want to make sure they have the funding necessary. Obviously, like I said, especially my producers here on the Central Coast are very self-sufficient. They understand that it's very important not just to have a product, but to protect the people who produce that product. And so they're stepping up, but they could always use some more help. And that's what we want to do for them. That's our responsibility being in government to make sure that they get those resources necessary and the funding behind those resources.
That was Central Coast Congressman Jimmy Panetta speaking with KCBX's Greta Mart. A group of linguists at UC Santa Cruz are on a mission to save a rarely studied endangered language. Through investigation and collaboration, they hope to preserve an indigenous language spoken by communities from Mexico now living in the Monterey Bay Area. KAZU's Michelle Loxton reports.
Within the cities of Santa Cruz and Watsonville are Zapotec speakers. They are diaspora communities, meaning they're a scattered population originating from somewhere else. In this case, these indigenous communities originate from Oaxaca in southern Mexico. Many came to California as migrant farm workers, particularly in the 1980s. Maziar Tusar-Vandani is the lead linguist on this project to preserve the language. He says Zapotec is a group of languages that hasn't been very well studied.
We have a general sense of what these languages are like at a sort of high level. But when you go down to the level of, like, how do people in a specific town speak, for most towns in Oaxaca, there's nothing written.
The linguists will be focusing on one variety of Zapotec. Tusar-Vandani says this language has a really vibrant way of referring to things in the world.
Zapotec has a particularly rich system of pronouns that encodes fine degrees of animacy, so how alive or human something is. It has, in fact, four pronouns that refer to elder humans, non-elder humans, animals, and things.
Linguists refer to a language as being endangered when there is a threat to the number of speakers. So why does a language become endangered?
A lot of minority communities are under pressure, not necessarily from a single powerful group, but they're under pressure nonetheless to give up speaking their language for a variety of reasons.
Globalization being one of them.
They may be, in some sense, forced to give up their language because in order to make a living, they need to speak the language of the outside, maybe of the nation or of other communities.
Tusar-Vandani and his team are approaching the preservation of this indigenous language in two ways. One, investigation.
Part of our work is basic documentation, understanding the basic properties of the language. How does it construct its sentences? Those kinds of questions.
And two, preservation.
It's important to the speakers. Speakers want to speak their language.
And if these languages are not preserved, we risk losing them and the stories of their speakers. Like this traditional tale in Zapotec about a saint's festival preserved by UC Santa Cruz linguists. The story is told by deceased Oaxacan elder Isidro Vasquez Geronimo. It starts, "Now, when the day of the fiesta comes, the musicians arrive." First, they light fireworks, he said. Then, he said, the municipal authorities announced through the sound system that the people of the town should come welcome the visiting band. By studying Zapotec, local linguists are able to go beyond saving the language and also serve this local community, one of their main goals. Tusar-Vandani says many Zapotec speakers are not able to receive basic services because of language barriers. They've collaborated with the Santa Cruz nonprofit Senderos, which helps local indigenous communities stay connected to their Oaxacan roots through dance, food, and language lessons. And the Monterey Bay Area is full of linguistic diversity. Zapotec isn't the only indigenous language spoken locally that linguists are working to preserve. There's also Mixtec, Mixe, and Chatino, to name just a few.
That was KAZU's Michelle Loxton reporting. When wildfires burn in our national parks, we naturally worry about the forest. But what about the photographs, maps, and documents that tell the stories of our parks? How do we keep those important archives safe? Valley Public Radio's Alice Daniel spoke with Emmy Lynn, librarian and head of digital curation at the University of California, Merced, about moving records from Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks to the university during last September's intense wildfires.
Thank you so much, Emily Lynn, for joining us. I know you and the curator of the archives of these national parks had been talking about digitizing the collections for several years because of the threat of wildfires. And the wildfires were so intense in September that the decision to get it done was essentially made for you. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that came about?
Yes, Ward Eldridge, who's the curator there, you know, Ward reached out to me in September when the administrative headquarters where the archives are were actually under direct threat, and the matter became much more urgent. So we talked on a Monday afternoon, and I think we got everything going in about 24 hours to move the collections from there up to Merced.
And Sequoia is the second oldest national park in the U.S., so I assume one can trace the thinking around managing public lands by just looking at the archives. Do all parks have archives, and what is particularly unique about the records you've seen?
Yes, many of the parks have archives. The Sequoia and Kings Canyon archives are partly of interest because of the evolution of the way parks and park managers have thought about fire science. So the evolving understanding of the importance of natural fires to the survival of the sequoias, the renewal, of the sequoias. So that being able to trace that evolution in thinking and the changes around management of fires in particular is unique. But also I think Sequoia, is the tree, the giant trees have been iconic to this idea of saving these lands, right? So being able to trace that history of how really the development of how we preserve lands and how we see public use of lands has changed is really, really fascinating.
And I know documentary filmmaker Ken Burns accessed these records while making his National Park series for television. Who else can benefit from these archives? In other words, why do they matter so much?
Well, we can pick out an iconic photograph or, it's really interesting to be able to read about how the first superintendent, John White, for example, how his thinking about land and land conservation changed and the role of science in management changed. But being able to read that from a very personal point of view in terms of his records is important, I think, because it brings these issues to a very personal level. So it's not just documentarians, but I think what I see is the value in communicating this to the next generation, to our students, to folks who are really interested in the history. There's nothing that can replace kind of the personal voice that comes through in some of these records.
Exactly. And these parks don't just happen, people make them happen. And you mentioned Ward Eldridge kept these records when they were in the park. People could make appointments to access information, but it wasn't super accessible. And now that the collections are part of UC Merced, how will access change?
Once they're here, we would love to have more researchers be able to see these collections and to use them. Now, what is amazing too is that you're able to see the extent when you're looking at a collection like the the files of, the park managers, you can see kind of the totality of how an organization like the Park Service has changed over time. We look at individual items and, you know, they're very special, like a diary or a diary of a ranger, for example, or, the reports of the first superintendent. But when you also look at the whole scope of these records, you can see how the park management actually shifted, that in the 50s, 60s, 70s, there was this very deliberate increase in terms of the science that was conducted in these parks, the wildlife surveys, the data that was collected to really inform how decisions are made about the use of land.
And you'll be digitizing these records?
Yeah, so what we hope to do is digitize significant collections so that people can be able to see that extent more readily. But certainly when they're here on campus, you know, we have researchers who are spending time in the Sierra Nevada, you know, region conducting current day research, but for them to be able to look back at what has already been collected, what data has already been collected, and you know, the analyses that have been done in the past, that's really important to do that kind of compare and contrast.
Great. Well, I'm sure that many people listening look forward to accessing some of these records. I'm sure people are very curious about the way the park was managed and is managed now. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Sure.
That was Valley Public Radio's Alice Daniel speaking with Emily Lin, librarian and head of digital curation at the University of California, Merced. For 26 years, the name Loralee Salvaggio was known to KCBX listeners through her weekly show From Ballet to Broadway. And for decades, she was known to the larger San Luis Obispo community for her world of dance. Loralee Salvaggio died of ovarian cancer in late 2020 at age 73. KCBX's Greta Mart spoke to three people who knew Salvaggio well in this remembrance of the late San Luis Obispo icon.
Born and raised in Modesto, California, Loralee Salvaggio studied ballet from a young age.
My mother and her sister, Diana, also trained in San Francisco. So her parents would drive her into the city to train classically. And by the age of 18, my mother was actually a professional ballroom dancer and winning competitions internationally.
That's Salvaggio's youngest daughter, Alexa.
She really got her start in ballroom dance, but was, of course, classically trained, did some TV work in LA, was on several, you know, shows as a professional dancer. And then when she moved to San Luis Obispo, began her own dance school.
Salvaggio earned a teaching degree before moving to San Luis Obispo with her first husband, who attended Cal Poly. After not finding any luck getting a local teaching job, she opened up a dance school in her garage at age 21. In 1977, she founded the Civic Ballet of San Luis Obispo, the first professional ballet company on the Central Coast.
She did everything from take dancers to the People's Republic of China, to an exchange in Spain, to taking dancers to Cuba. It was actually the first time since 1957 that Americans had even been on a cultural exchange in Cuba.
50 years later, the Slo Civic Ballet is still going strong, led by her son, Drew. And at age 50, Loralee Salvaggio switched gears. She went back to school to become a psychotherapist and opened up her own practice in Stockton.
Lori, she had this amazing gift where she could lift anybody up if they were feeling down. And how she would do it is she would engage you with questions that brought out the best of you. I saw her do it with her kids. I saw her do it with students and volunteers of the ballet and even her closest friends. And so it was pretty clear that she would move into the healing arts of being a therapist because she already innately had those gifts.
That's her close friend, Jennifer Bloomfield.
She and I became friends, and her children and my children danced together and did the China show and the Cuba show. And then we moved across the street from each other. So once I moved on to Bouchon Street, my kids and I lived at Lori's house.
Many who knew Salvaggio spoke of her drive and her ambition, but not just for herself.
It kind of all is involved in helping other people get to where they want to. I know the whole ballet company was because she studied ballet and stuff, but she never had the opportunity to completely achieve her dreams because her body type, or back then, and me too, really hard. They looked for a long, tall ballerina with a long neck and skinny. And, you know, if you didn't have that right body type and that right, you know, turnout and feet and everything, you had no chance to be a ballerina. And I think she started the company for that reason, to let people that aren't, you know, perfect ballerinas train and become perfect ballerinas. Today, it's completely different. You can, you know, become a ballerina with any type of body, any turnout. It's the work that you put forward into things. And I think that's what she brought up in her students. It's not what you look like, it's how much work you put into it to become successful. And she gave people the opportunity to be up on stage being the sugar plum fairy when maybe they never would in some other situation. So I think giving opportunity to her students and kind of a work ethic and a method of leading their lives, whether they were dancers or not, that you work for the things that you want to get in life. They aren't just handed to you. And that's what she did. She worked for the things that she wanted in her life, and she worked hard and she achieved them.
Jackie Lee teaches at the Academy of Dance and is a ballet mistress.
I just walked in and asked her for a job. That was the first time I met her.
Lee ended up working with Salvaggio for years.
We like had a little group that she took around even to try to audition for like cruise ships and things like that. She was just involved. She got ideas in her head and she just went full out for them always. She never did anything halfway.
Helene Dinsmore was six when her mother enrolled her at Salvaggio's Academy of Dance. 40 years later, she still dances with the company.
Words that come to mind when I think of her, she was captivating. She would give amazing speeches to us of encouragement. She was inspiring. She just had really high expectations of her company, her dancers, the performances she put out.
Dinsmore says she's danced in every slow civic ballet nutcracker since 1982, except for the year her daughter was born.
And she just pushed you to be the best. Like, she taught more than just dance steps. I mean, she taught the discipline that like I've carried throughout my whole life and other parts of my life, and just respect and doing your best and pushing yourself to be the best. And she just was very inspiring. I mean, that's the main word that comes to mind when I think of her.
Dinsmore, Bloomfield, and Lee all say Laura Lee Salvaggio made her mark by lifting up others.
She definitely has a big legacy that's still going strong in this community. And I think it benefits many people. So on the stage and in the audience, I think it's just a really special thing to be a part of. So
I just think her persuasiveness into getting things done with the people around her, her drive, her always wanting to go to the next level. She's got this studio that's in her garage, and then all of a sudden she has one downtown, and then she has a jazz companies, and then she has a ballet company, and then, you know, she just keeps going. And then she goes back to school and becomes, you know, a psychotherapist. And then she, you know, she just does more in her lifetime to, I think, make an impression and kind of a life path for others than most people do, definitely. She made her footprint in the world.
Reporting for KCBX, I'm Greta Mart.
One of the highlights of the recent presidential inauguration was the reading of a poem. We'll hear from a local poet who came by poetry through songwriting, most famously her extensive work with Carole King and the song It's Too Late. Central Coast resident Tony Stern just released a new book of poetry.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local author and poet Tony Stern. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. It's nice speaking with you again, Brian.
I look forward to discussing your wonderful new book of poems, Loops, L-O-O-P-S, which impressed me greatly. But before we get into that, I'd like to learn a little bit more about you and your background. And basically, because I know that you started out, at least professionally, with as a lyricist for some pretty famous people. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, well, I was born and grew up in Hollywood, so I knew people in the music business and in show business. And my friend Bert Schneider, a producer who created the Monkees, was in his office when and visited by Carole King, who had just moved from New York to Los Angeles, divorced from her lyricist husband, and looking at opportunities to pursue a career, her career in Los Angeles. So in the meantime, Bert had encouraged me to write lyrics. He said, that's what your generation is doing, and you're so verbal. Why don't you give it a go? So I did. In two 9-hour sessions, I wrote 4 lyrics. And since I was out of the country, I sent him those lyrics. Carole came to visit him. He pulled the lyrics out of his drawer. This is, as I'm told, showed them to Carole. And her response was, these are good. Did you write these? And he said, no, my friend Tony Stern did. Well, that led to a meeting at a Sony apartment building on the Sunset Boulevard that they kept for visiting artists. And Carole and I met, and it went well. And from that moment on, she wrote exclusively with me and I with her for the next 5 years. The first 4 songs that I wrote, which I had no idea if they were songs or not, but it just turns out that I had been listening unknowingly so intently to songs my whole life that I had it was already built in. All of those songs got covered by lesser artists than I can even remember now, but that was considered a home run. So we made 2 albums before Tapestry with the same group of people, Charlie Larkey on bass, Danny Korchmar on electric guitar, Carole on piano, and Russ Kunkel on drums. And they were wonderful albums, but they didn't enjoy the success of then the 3rd album, Tapestry, came out and was an instant success. And we rolled on from there, and it was wonderful.
I know, as a person who was around and listening to music at the time, that album is iconic. I mean, it's, I don't know if it's as big as the Beatles, but in and of itself, you know, set up a tone or an example. It's pretty huge and remains so today. Must give you goosebumps.
Well, it's certainly a classic, and it's wonderful to, I have a godchild who's 16. She knows all the lyrics to Tapestry, and not just because her godmother wrote them, because where she goes to school, Tapestry is one of the albums that they are steeping themselves in.
Interesting.
It's wonderful, and the attention that we still get. Tapestry is enjoying its 50-year anniversary this year, so the attention it is getting has been ramped up even more. And when Beautiful, the musical, came out, that was even more attention. It just keeps on going. And then a few years before Beautiful, James Taylor and Carole went out on the road, and it was the biggest selling concert venue of that particular summer. So, and I listen to the album, I hear its freshness, I hear its credibility, if you will, for now. It's just a wonderful compilation of songs, cooperation, beauty, sincerity. It's a great album.
I believe that so much of life is random, and so for something like this to come together, there are probably some higher forces at work. Would you like to read one of the poems from your new book, Loops?
Oh, thank you. I will. This one is called So Close. I had a lot of fun with this one guy, a painter, but he couldn't make a living at it and moved back to Belgium. I heard he teaches art therapy at a mental hospital and plans to marry his childhood sweetheart. There's a new man in my life. He lives in the building directly opposite mine. I like watching television when he does, and if I can tell what he's having for dinner, I'll make the same thing for myself. He eats a lot of spaghetti, then, for dessert, vanilla ice cream, straight out of the container. My dad did that. It drove my mother crazy, but I wouldn't mind.
Wow. Before I comment, I would like to remind everyone this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Tony Stern, local poet and author and famous lyricist, having worked with Carole King and others. That I don't know quite what to make of these poems because they don't rhyme and they don't there's not a rhythm per se. It's more like a snapshot, but I guess for me it qualifies absolutely as poetry because there's so much packed into what you said, what you wrote, that almost every word, every sentence, every color, every taste, sound, it almost explodes. What generally speaking has been the reaction of people to your poetry like this? Is it like me or am I just an oddball?
No, you're not an oddball at all. I am overwhelmed with the response that I've been getting. You know, this is my third book of poetry. I get emails and then from someone, and then I'll get another email and another email just reiterating their pleasure that they get at the book, and keep writing, keep writing, keep writing, they'll say. The producer of Beautiful, the producer and creator of the musical Beautiful, wrote me a wonderful email reiterating in his mind how important brevity and getting to the point is, and how difficult it is to write. It's easy to write a lot of words, but it's more difficult to write a few words. I think it was Pascal who said, if I'd had more time, I would have written a shorter letter.
You know, poetry, both written and spoken, but in the early days spoken before we had written language, has been huge in the evolution of the human race, telling stories of, you know, royal genealogy to failed romance to war and peace, if not written down, composed and sung by the poet. They were entertaining kings and leaders. How do you feel to be a part of that amazing tradition?
Well, it feels as if I were born to it, Brian. It gives me a great deal of pleasure. At the end of the day, no matter how busy it is, if I haven't written anything, I have the really ridiculous feeling that I haven't accomplished anything. Hmm. So there's something about creating something out of nothing that just appeals to me. It's in a way the God principle, creating something out of nothing. In a way I am mimicking creation, if you will. I am nature. So I'm just doing what I was born to do, if you will.
The idea of shifting from rhyme and meter to a form of free verse or whatever the proper term is, do you feel it's the best and latest aspect of poetry, or is it just a different path that is taken?
Well, I think I've seen it been called prose poetry. And as far as rhythm goes, rhythm is one of the main things that drive these poems. While the rhythm might not be obvious, which is a good thing, part of the struggle of creating a poem that sings, if you will, is finding the rhythm. So my prose poetry relies as heavily on rhythm as anything that is rhymed, metered, in stanzas, etc. And I believe that prose poetry is one of the avenues of modern poetry, not the avenue.
Right, of course, that makes sense. Do you write more and then pare it down into less, like a person would just brainstorm ideas and then what's left over is all the clutter removed, or does it just come out more or less finished without editing?
No, that I wish. I write what I would say too much, and then I take away. And so I want to get down to the juicy part,
right,
part that tells the tale without telling it twice, without explaining, without commenting on it. I want to leave my dear reader all the room in the world to participate in the poem, I guess I would say.
Of course, of course. Could you read us another one, please?
Oh, thank you, I will. So this is called Late Summer. The air is so thick with smoke and the ash right now, I doubt I'll make it. Serves me right for dragging my heels. When I do get to town, I buy in bulk. Sacks of flour, rice, beans, cans of creamed corn, sardines, spinach, tomatoes, things like that. I keep chickens, so I'm rolling in eggs. The cat fends for herself. The wildfires will relent. The songbirds will return. And the cat and I, for reasons of our own, will savor the abundance.
I was listening for the rhythm. I don't know. It's elusive, I guess I would say, but it's there all the same and encouraging and inviting and very inspirational. Let's try to end this with one last poem, if we may.
All right. It's called Self-Reliance. I need two, so I buy three in case I lose one. I want to head west, but it's into the sun, so I'm driving north. I need directions, but I'm too proud to ask. I'm hungry, but too self-conscious to dine alone. I need sleep, but I can't decide where to pull over.
These poems are revelatory of you as a person and as an artist. And does that ever bother you, or is it a little scary?
No, better that I out myself than somebody else out me. Yeah,
you're in control of that.
You know, once I've put it out there, nobody can throw it back at me because it'll just bounce right off.
As a final thought, what would you say to a person, young or old, who says, well, I don't read much. I certainly don't read poetry.
Well, I expect that school ruined their enthusiasm for poetry because they were inundated with perhaps great poems, but they were way beyond the child's understanding of them. And the formality to which poetry enjoyed, read in the sonorous, is that the word, tone very seriously professorial, it's a turnoff.
Right.
But modern prose is not like that at all. It can go anywhere and do anything, and has in the last 20, 30 years gone everywhere. So I would like teachers to lighten up and to expand their awareness of modern poetry. I would like for the children to be given an opportunity to enjoy it, because it's fun, it's engaging, it's grounding. All children want to be grounded, or search to be grounded. I'm going to read one more really quickly, if I may. It's called Utopia. Mommy, Charlotte said, is there really such a place as Utopia? Only in books, my darling, her mother said. Only in books.
I would like to remind everyone, this has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Toni Stern, local poet and author, discussing poetry in general, but in particular her brand new book, Loops. Thank you so much, Toni.
Thank you very much, Brian. Nice speaking with you.
On today's episode of Playing with Food, Father Ian Dellinger heads to the harbor to learn about a fishing industry that many of us on the Central Coast are not familiar with. At least, we don't expect to find it here in California.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food.
We have to count how many lobsters there are now for the fishing game, for our records.
When we think of lobster, we think of Maine lobster with its giant claws, a 2-pound lobster tail next to a 24-ounce steak, or big chunks of lobster meat bursting from the brioche bun of a lobster roll. We don't think of the palm trees and sandy beaches of Santa Barbara, but that's precisely where I stumbled upon a California spiny lobster fisherman bringing in his catch into the harbor after a 3-day stint out in the Channel Islands. Tired of frozen lobster shipped from 3,000 miles away? Then look no further than Santa Barbara Harbor.
My name is Charlie Graham. I'm a commercial lobster and crab fisherman out of Santa Barbara, and the name of my boat is the March Gale.
Charlie and I chatted while he was clearing up after his 3-day haul and sale of his lobster. We were on the March Gale, surrounded by all his equipment, his personal catch of lobster, and his dog, Davy.
Lobster and crab are my main two fisheries. I started in 1993 crewing for somebody, and then I built some of my own traps in 94 and fished them off of his boat, and then I got my own boat in 95. This is my third boat.
Where do you go to get them?
Channel Islands and up the coast from Santa Barbara. Yeah, lobster season runs from the first Wednesday of October until the first Wednesday after the 15th of March. It's been a good season so far. We are doing a lot better with the price. Last season we were suffering with the China trade war, fishing under some really heavy tariffs. Typically in recent years we've started getting about $18 a pound on opening day, and then by the end of the season we might get up to like 23, maybe even 25 bucks. And then last season, under the retaliatory tariffs from China, we only got $11 instead of the $18. So that hurt really badly. When we got up as high as $13, we hit $15 briefly for like a week or two, and then the coronavirus, China stopped accepting all shipments of lobster, and the price tanked at $8 a pound. We can't even make money at that. We just don't do the volume that we would have to do in order to make money at that kind of price. We need a higher price for this fishery to be viable.
When you came in, you said you had 182 lobster, and you were holding up trophies of a 10-pound, 6-ounce lobster. So that would go, if at $26.50, that would be a $270 lobster?
Right. Yeah, that was 10.6 pounds, that one. We get a few big ones every trip. Sometimes we don't get very many lobsters at all, and sometimes we get a whole bunch. And so this trip I got a whole bunch. We had a swell last week, and that tends to stir them around whenever we have like big waves or you have some rain, low pressure system comes in, that tends to move them around. And then to the contrary, when we have high pressure, when we get the Santa Ana winds and water gets real clear, and we have that shuts down the fishing. Same with a full moon, because the light from the moon makes the lobsters vulnerable to predation by other things that eat them, like sheephead and cabazon and lingcod and all these fish. Octopus are the big one. It's best to let the trap sit for a couple of days. It's best to not bait them on a full moon. You're kind of asking for it. You get a bunch of lobsters that are missing legs, and I have a couple of them here that I'll take home for my family. You're not going to sell a lobster that's missing a bunch of legs to China for full price. There's another one that's lost its legs to octopus or sheephead. But they're still alive and they're still good to eat. So I save those for my friends and family. The part of the lobster that you eat is mainly the tail. There is some meat in the body, but mostly it's in the tail. But if you like cut this lobster in half and clean it, there is meat up in here. And that's my favorite way to cook them, is actually split them in half and put them either in the broiler or on the barbecue.
Charlie had been out near the Channel Islands for 3 days. What goes on out there?
So the traps go out in the beginning of the season. It takes a week or so to get all your traps out, and then they come home at the end of the season. And in between, you're just moving them around to different locations. Most guys are fishing 200 to 300 traps. If you're really moving fast, you could get through 300 traps in a day. I don't. I mean, I have, but it takes me a couple days to get through my gear. And then this is a small trap. We have another size that's a larger size. This is a 3 feet wide by, or long by 28 inches wide. We chop up mackerel, which is in these white boxes here. Put it in a bait cup. It's got holes in it, right? And then put the bait cup in the bait basket, which is here. This rope and buoy would be outside, obviously. Close up the door. By law, we have to have the door has to be hinged with these special clips. They're just raw steel. They can't be aluminum or stainless. They can't have any tar on them or anything. And the idea is that if somebody runs over your trap and you can't find your trap because the buoy's been cut off by a propeller or something. And you, also by law, we have to have a stretch device. So a lot of guys use bungee cord to pull tension this way, so that if you lose your trap, these clips are going to rust out. The tension of the bungee cord is going to pull the door open, so whatever's in there can get out. And this is an escape port. This lets the sub-legal size lobsters out. Even lobsters that are just over legal size can still actually get through that. So these traps are made out of galvanized steel, and then we dip them in tar once a season to help keep them from corroding, and then put a zinc on them.
So your traps are out there, and you said they're out there for the entire season. So your job is to go out, when you go out on a trip, is to simply just check them and empty them?
Yeah, so you pull up to your buoy, put it in the hauler up there, pull up the trap, open up the door, and swap out the bait, get rid of the old bait, put a fresh bait cup in there, measure the lobsters. We have a gauge that tells you whether it's a legal size lobster or not. So our size limit is 3 1/4 inches. And that's measured across the carapace. Those 10 pounders, they would be bigger than two of these across there.
You said you were out for 3 to 5 days. Is that because you have 300 traps out there that you have to check?
Yeah, or you know, maybe you're gonna pull some of them a couple of times. Tomorrow I'll just go for a day trip. And it depends on the weather and how the fishing is. And you know, there's all kinds of factors that determine how long your trip is gonna be.
When you came in, I saw that you had 55-gallon garbage cans full of live lobster, and you were out for 3 days. How long can a lobster live out of water?
No problem, 24 hours if it's cool. Like sometimes a lobster will jump out of the barrel when you're driving back and you don't realize it, and I'll sell my catch and I won't see him on the deck of the boat and come back down here like the following day. He's there on the deck alive still, no problem. It just depends, like if it's a hot day, then not as long, but if it's the weather's cool, they can stay alive quite a bit out of water. But those guys will buy the lobsters from us. They put them in their back of their truck, which has big tanks with salt water filtered, and it's got aeration, adds air.
And they export them. They're not. Yeah. These are not for the domestic market.
That's for both, but mostly these are going to China, but there is some domestic market too. This fishery doesn't compete well with domestic markets historically. The East Coast lobsters are a lot less expensive. They do high volume. They catch so much more than we do that they can survive and make money at a lower price than we can. If we get paid the same amount that they're getting paid, our fishery is not viable. Well, when I first started fishing, I was selling them for $7. Now we're getting $20 today, maybe 23 by the end of the season, 25, who knows, we'll see. Depends what's going on with the world market.
You mentioned East Coast lobster. These lobster look very different than the East Coast lobster. They don't have claws.
Yeah, it's a lost claws. There's no claws on these lobster. This is a spiny lobster, but they're very sought after, and the Chinese really like our spiny lobster, and they're willing to pay for them. We really need that high price to be viable, and we're sort of at the edge of the resource here. Santa Barbara is the furthest northern port that anybody fishes lobster out of. Nobody fishes them north of here because the water gets too cold. We're at the edge of the biology of the species, the Southern California Bight, basically. Point Arguello and Point Conception are the westernmost edge of it, of the fishery. All of California accounts for about 18% of the spiny lobster production. And the remaining 82% historically has come from Baja, Mexico.
Do they taste different?
From East Coast lobster, people say that these ones are a little sweeter. I like them both. I've been back east and eaten those lobsters. I like lobster, this one or that one, and crab too.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, talking lobster with Charlie Graham.
When we first got in touch, I said, is it possible that I could go out with you? But you gave me a reason that I can't.
Well, yeah, you have to be a licensed crew member. Otherwise, you can't touch anything, basically. You can't be in fishing gear. You can't participate in anything. I'm mostly doing 3-day trips. There's just enough room for me and my dog, basically.
And where do you actually sleep on this boat?
I have a bunk up there. It's called the V-berth. And that's where Davy sleeps, too. We do good out here, but traditionally I've fished alone. I've used a crew member a little bit in my career, but mostly I like to fish alone. Oh, I ran over somebody's buoy. It happens. Usually you run over your own because those are the ones you're pulling up to most frequently. But yeah, I ran over John's buoy. Then it's like wrapped around your propeller. You can't just like forget about it. You gotta like dive over and cut it out. I saved his trap. I retied the rope and put his buoy back on. But yeah, so that's why I have my wetsuit and my mask and snorkel. It happens a few times a season. It's not the highlight of my day, but it's not a big deal. You know, usually I don't put on a wetsuit, but it was kind of cold today. I suited up, and usually I can do it in one breath hold, but today was a little more complicated. Depends how many wraps you get around the drive shaft.
But you saved the trap.
Yeah, I saved his trap. It's important for people to know that the lobster fishery is a good, healthy, sustainable fishery. Over the years, I've been involved with a number of different collaborative research projects with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife and also the various scientists and researchers out at UCSB. They're all aimed at sustainability. So we've done things like stock assessments and port sampling, and a tag recapture project is where researchers would come out with you. You pull up traps with lobster, both legal and sublegal, shorts we call them, and they put a tag on the lobster. They put it right here behind the carapace. It's a little plastic tag that is retained even when the lobster molts. Then they throw the lobster back with a tag now. So here's a tag. This is tag number 2751. Cal Lobster was the project, Cal Lobster Research. There's a phone number there. It says record tag number and length and the GPS, and then call the number. So over time, that information goes into a database. They know when they caught that lobster and tagged it originally, how big it was, where it was, and they know the date. When somebody calls in that information, now they can go, okay, in this amount of time, that lobster moved from here and it was now caught over here. They now also know how much it grew. And if it's a short lobster, that lobster could be thrown back and caught several times. And so that data keeps getting put into the system and it starts to show migration patterns and growth patterns. And they move a lot. They move miles. It's pretty impressive.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, learning from lobster fisherman Charlie Graham what to do with live lobster. I haven't had lobster in a very long time. The last time I cooked lobster was on the island of Islay, off the west coast of Scotland. This was as good an opportunity as any to get tips on the best way to cook and to stag myself a lobster straight out of the ocean.
What is your favorite way to prepare lobster and to eat lobster?
My favorite way, how I do it the most, is to split them in half. I would start with a sharp knife and a cutting board, and I would start here. Lobsters don't have a brain, they have a ganglia, by the way. And I would first go straight down and then come this way in between their antenna, and then I'd flip them around and continue back down the tail. Once it's in two, you clean out the guts. You don't want to eat the viscera. And then just rinse that under running water in the sink. If they're on the barbecue, you can like put a little olive oil on the grill to keep it from sticking, and then do them like the meat side down first to sear them for a couple minutes, and then turn them over. And now the shell is like the shape of a cup to hold the butter and garlic, anything else you want to put in there. The other way to do it is in a broiler. You can kind of do the same thing with a broiler. If it's a cold night, you don't want to barbecue.
Is it possible for me to buy a lobster from you?
Yeah, I do have a retail permit, and I can sell you a lobster.
Okay, so how do I get it home, and how long do I have to prepare it?
I'm going to give you a bag to put it in. And how far away do you live?
I live in Slow. I live about 2 hours away.
It'll be fine. By the time you get home, you can cook them when you get home.
Okay. Could I cook it tomorrow if I put it in the fridge?
Yeah, you could. I wouldn't wait till maybe tomorrow night, but, you know, you probably could be fine. It slows them down, too. A lot of people don't like to deal with a flapping lobster. If you put them in the fridge, it slows their metabolism down. So they're not going to be as lively because it's so cold. You know, they're easier to handle. They do have spikes on them all over, and spines, I should say. They're spiny lobsters. See these guys?
Yeah.
Oh. Those will poke right through your gloves.
Yeah.
They're all over the antennae. You know, the horns, the tail has them. They've made me bleed numerous times, so you have to be careful handling them. I wear some thick gloves. This is a good way to pick them up by the antenna like that, too. There or here. Even if they flap, if you have a good purchase on them, it won't get away from you.
And do I have to use the knife method, or can I use the boil method?
You can just take that whole guy and put him in a pot of boiling water.
Okay.
It's easy.
If you kill a lobster incorrectly, you can kill yourself, right?
You might lose a finger if you have a good sharp knife.
But don't they release like a poison or something?
No. There's something called domoic acid that comes and goes. Right now, it's not really around in the channel. You would have to eat a lot of it. Really, it's I wouldn't suggest eating the viscera. It's not something I do anyways. Stick to the meat and you're fine.
Okay. Yeah. I'm not going to like suck the head out.
Yeah, you know, they call that the tamale. That's more of an East Coast lobster thing. I don't care for that stuff. I just clean it out and it goes in the trash or down the sink. The other thing you could do, just put them right in the freezer and then you can store them. You can eat them at a later date if you didn't want to eat them tomorrow.
It will have died though in the freezer, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I drove the 2 hours home with the unsettling knowledge that there was a live lobster wrapped in nothing but paper in the back of my car. Even though the lobster had no legs, I couldn't help the vision in my head that I would look into the rearview mirror and there would be a giant lobster crawling through the car to attack me. I got home, put him into the freezer, and plotted what I was going to do with him. I truly felt that I was creating my own murder mystery story. I was genuinely surprised to discover fresh lobster on the Central Coast. I was even more surprised that it's really not that difficult to prepare. I barbecued it like Charlie described to me and ate half the tail with drawn butter. I made lobster mac and cheese with the other half of the tail. And I made lobster bisque. It was nice, but not my favorite. Like everyone else, I like the big chunks of meat in the tail, and of course the California spiny lobster doesn't have any claws, so it's just the tail. For me to play with lobster meant Charlie had to do the hard work to make it available to me. I can't just go to the beach, cast a trap, and come home an hour later with a lobster. But on the other hand, to get that fresh lobster, I had to meet him on the dock. Why isn't there easier access?
I used to sell at farmers markets, and I stopped doing it because I'd rather just be out fishing than dealing with... If that's all you're doing and you're not trying to be a fisherman too, you know, that's one thing, but... I'm going to focus on fishing and have time to see my girlfriend, too. You got to prioritize things.
Everyone deserves to spend more time with their loved ones. Thanks for what you do, Charlie. And some of his catch does end up in local farmers markets. It's just not Charlie behind the stand. So get yourself some fresh California spiny lobster and enjoy yet another amazing food from the Central Coast. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.org.